Welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, John Mark Grodi, here on EWTN. And once again, we have this great privilege to come together and hear a story of faith. We're joined tonight by Michael Mason, a former evangelical Protestant, and he's a Catholic high school teacher in the Archdiocese of Cincinnati. Michael, thanks for being here tonight.
Thank you for having me. This is a real pleasure.
It's a real honor to have you and to hear your story. We're going to talk about it later, but you went through Southern Evangelical Seminary as part of your story, and we have had a number of your colleagues from there tell their stories on the show previously. So,
yep.
So excited to hear more about that.
Great.
Yeah.
And the journey home had a big role in my conversion as well. There was probably literally every night for a couple years when I would iron my shirts for work the next day, I would put on one of your guys' programs to listen to it. So the journey home has a special role in my conversion as well.
Great to hear it. Glory to God.
Yep.
You know, he's the author of the stories, and we're glad to be able to hear to help bring them to the world.
So. Yeah. Great.
Well, thanks for being here. I'll invite you to take a step way back. Where does your journey begin?
My journey begins, I'm from Northwest Ohio. Fremont, Ohio is where I was born. I was raised in a really good family. I have two wonderful parents, a great brother that I'm still very close to. I was very blessed to not only have parents who loved each other and had a great marriage, but also had an extended family with aunts and uncles and lots of cousins, where faith was important to all of us. And it was just a really positive way to grow up. It's really wonderful. My parents were committed to the faith. They are Christians, but we weren't in church every single Sunday when I was growing up. They had the opinion that they wanted to expose me to Christianity, but also they wanted to give me an opportunity to choose it for myself. When I was in middle school, we moved to a town called Upper Sandusky, Ohio, which is about 45 miles south of Fremont. And at that point, I'm entering middle school, and it's time to consider baptism and confirmation. I was raised in a Methodist church. And so they take us down to Upper Sandusky. As I'm there, we start attending this church, and I start going to classes for confirmation. And we had a great pastor there. He was dynamic. When he would preach, he'd get, you know, he had white hair, and his face would get all red because he'd get so passionate. He was like an old school Methodist preacher, which was really wonderful.
Yeah.
And so I just really took to him. Our whole family did. At that season in our lives, we'd started attending church every Sunday. Faith became very important to us. And I remember when our pastor was talking to us about his conversion to Christianity, accepting Jesus into his heart. He told us the story that he was at his farmhouse and he knelt down in his room next to the window overlooking the pasture and he accepted Jesus into his heart. And so when I decided I wanted to do that as well, I didn't want to mess it up. So I went home. Now we lived in town, so it wasn't quite as beautiful as his. Yeah, that's right. But I remember getting down beside my window and I got on my knees and I overlooked the backyard and accepted Jesus into my heart because I didn't want to mess it up,
right.
You know, first time through. But I had this great experience with them. Went to church camp, all those things. At the end of middle school, we moved to a small town called Gibsonburg, Ohio, which is in between Fremont and Bowling Green. Mm-hmm. It's a rural community, you know, about 2,500 people, one stoplight. To some people, that might sound dull. To me, I just loved it because there's nothing to do. So you hang out with your buddies and fill your time. When we moved, though my faith was important to me, I didn't transition well. I remember getting a phone call from a gentleman that I met at a youth camp and asked if I'd be interested in doing a Christian group at my high school campus. And I was real honest with him and said, I'm a new student and I just don't feel comfortable doing that. And he nice enough said, you know, that's fine. That moment was pivotal for me even all these years later because my faith didn't come with me to high school and it really didn't come with my family as much either. When I got into high school, I had lived a very stereotypical Midwestern existence for a high school kid. We would go to church from time to time, usually Christmas and Easter. We didn't talk about faith around the family and things like a lot, but it was important to my family and the wider family, but we weren't real committed to it. I read the Bible from time to time, but most of the time I was really interested in playing football, playing baseball, and hanging out with my friends. For the first 2 years of high school, we would do just that. So on the weekends to fill our free time, we would play pickup tournaments in my driveway, 3-on-3, and have brackets and play till midnight. Or we would string up lights between telephone poles and play tackle football so we'd have an outdoor stadium. So in that sense, it was a really, like, really beautiful way of growing up. But around being my junior year, I want to live a happy life. I know all of us do. And I remember consciously thinking, like, what is it that makes up a good and happy life? And I got the idea in my head, and I got it from people explicitly. It wasn't implied or picked up on television. That part of living a good and happy life is drinking alcohol and partying. I'm from a rural blue-collar community.
Yeah.
The guys will tell the old war stories when they're in high school as they played high school football and baseball and won these games. but you also had the wildness on the side. And when you're into sports like football and rugby, and it tends to draw guys who are a little on the wild side. And I found that very attractive. And so over Christmas break, my junior year of high school, I tried drinking alcohol for the first time because I thought that this is just what you do to live a well-rounded life. From that point forward, alcohol became a pretty standard weekend activity. My parents would not approve of this. So I want the listeners to know they would not approve of this. I had to hide it from them and put a lot of work into that. They were not the parents who were like, come on over to our house. That did not fly.
Right.
But alcohol, I'd start drinking on the weekends. Now, when you're in high school, I have great coaches and teachers and parents to kind of hem in my sin. And so a lot of the negative effects from it, morally and spiritually, didn't feel like they were taking root. There wasn't a lot of negative fruit coming from it, other than the occasional hangover the next day and maybe the fear of getting caught. Mm-hmm. But really, I didn't experience a lot of the negative parts because you're exercising for sports. I'm in school, have a lot of structure, and that was great. I was a pretty good high school football player. And by the end of my senior year, I was offered to play college football at mostly small schools. But I had a choice to make to either go to small schools, which were mostly in small towns, which is where I grew up, or just try a different path. And during high school, I went to a football camp at Ohio University, and I just loved Athens. Because when you're where I'm from, there's literally no hills for hundreds of square miles. The only hills you have are overpasses for freeways.
Right.
And so when I went to Athens, Ohio, the campus is beautiful, and it's like going to school in the Alps for a Northwest Ohio kid, because they have hills, and it's beautiful. And Southern Ohio always had a charm for me because it kind of looks like the Shire. If guys read The Lord of the Rings, it has that sort of feel down there. But I fell in love with it. And so I decided I wanted to try something different and go to a big state school. So I chose to go to Ohio University. I went there with the intention to get a degree in education. I wanted to teach history to middle schoolers because I love American history. And I wanted to coach high school football. And so that was the goal, is to get an education. Because I had it in my mind that I wanted to live this good and happy life and that partying was going to be a part of that, one of the reasons I chose Ohio University is because it has a reputation as a party school. And so I went down there with the full intention of sowing my wild oats for a few years. I was not going to fail out, so I went to class and studied and did those things. I wasn't interested in that. My parents instilled a better work ethic than that in me. But I did. I went down there to drink alcohol and smoke weed and chase women. My intention was to do that for 4 years. And afterwards, probably continue drinking, but never to party beyond that. I figured at some point I'd meet a cute girl, have some kids, coach Little League, and move on with life. Mm-hmm. And so I just assumed that I would engage in this party life and everything would be great. For the first couple years, it was great. Not great in the moral sense. Not great how I understand greatness now. But in the moment, it seemed like it was a really good choice. Partying's a lot of fun. It's very pleasurable. And, I had a good group of buddies to hang out with. And it really, for the first couple years, seemed to work pretty well. But because I partied very hard. We would go out on Tuesday nights, Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays every week for 3.5 years. And when I would go out drinking, it wasn't having 2 or 3 drinks over a game of pool. I would drink to excess almost every single time. I was smoking marijuana every single day for the first couple years I was there. And so slowly but surely, that started to chip away at me, not only morally, but just physically in lots of ways. As I was going through this, my sophomore year, I was in an education class with a girl named Corinne, and she was wonderful. And we struck up a friendship. And the way we struck it up is that Corinne was an evangelical Christian. And we were in one of those classes where they throw out questions for you to answer to get to know each other questions.
Right, right.
And the question was, what would you do if you knew you were going to die tomorrow? Well, I had enough good sense from my Methodist upbringing. I said, well, I would go to church. Because if I'm going to die tomorrow, I'm going to meet God, and I got to get myself right. Well, everyone else said all kinds of other bizarre things. But this little evangelical girl, that pricked her ears, and she was involved with a group from Campus Crusade for Christ, and they do initiative evangelism. Mm-hmm. So when she heard that, I mean, she was just like, this is a guy that I can talk to. So she and I struck up a friendship, and for 2.5 years, we would probably talk about faith 2 or 3 times a week in depth, and I would bring the conversations up. What I didn't know at that time is that she wrote my name on a prayer board that she and her roommates had, and they started praying for my conversion. I had no idea about this. Well, as this is going on, we're having these great discussions, And I start feeling guilty. And not only that, but morally, I mean, things just with the party life are weighing down heavy on me. And I remember one night I was sitting on my buddy's front porch, and we'd out drinking all night. I'd gotten high, and I was sitting on the porch smoking cigarettes, staring up at the sky, and I was talking to God. Because I knew the way I was living, he didn't want me to live this way. But I love it. I love the party life. And I looked at him one point, and I distinctly remember saying, I love sin more than I love you. And I said it vocally. And then when St. Paul talks in the book of Romans, that God will hand us over to our sins, I'm utterly convinced that in that moment, God handed me over to my sin. Whatever shroud of protection he'd put around me at that point, he decided to pull back. Within a couple months, so this is spring break, my junior year of college.
Right.
I was home for spring break, and I went to Bowling Green State University to hang out with my buddies. And as we're hanging out, we partied like usual. I got drunk like usual. And when I woke up the next morning, something didn't feel right. Now, I've had horrible hangovers before, but this was just, something was off, but I couldn't pinpoint what it was. And I remember driving home thinking, something doesn't feel right. But I didn't think much of it. That night, met up with a couple other buddies. We were watching a college football game and drinking White Russians. And I had probably 7 strong White Russians, and I'm just not getting drunk. We went to a local bar there in town in Fremont, and just hung out the rest of the night. And I remember drinking beer after beer after beer. And the more I drank, I felt sober. It's like the first time that day I felt clear-headed. Uh-huh. And I distinctly remember sitting at the bar thinking, this is bizarre. Like, why? I can't get drunk. And I realized at a point where, like, I could drink as much as I want tonight. Getting drunk's not in the cards for me. So I go home, go to bed. Next morning, wake up. This bizarre feeling returns. I can't pinpoint what it is, but it was a Sunday, so there's NFL football on. And I was in a side room at my parents' house watching a game. And I would find myself pacing in the room while I was watching the game. It was almost a little bit like an out-of-body experience, where next thing I know, I realize I'm walking in circles. And then I'd be like, what am I doing? I'd sit back down, start rocking back and forth, stand up, walking in circles. And I kept waking myself up from this, thinking, like, what am I? Sit back down. That night, my parents go to bed. This uncomfortable feeling's in me the whole time. I go to bed that night because I'm like, I just need to go to bed. Like, I don't feel weird. I'll feel better tomorrow. And I go into my room, and I turn the light off to go to sleep, and I am terrified of the dark. Now I'm 21 years old. Mm-hmm. I haven't been afraid of the dark since I was 4 or 5 years old. And I was utterly terrified. As soon as the light would go off, I mean, my whole body would, like, go into shock. And I'd have to turn on right away. So I go out in the living room, and I'm laying on the couch trying to go to sleep, and I just can't. This uncomfortable feeling won't go away. And so I turn TV on, and I just watch TV till 2 o'clock in the morning until I finally physically just fell asleep with all the lights on the TV on.
Yeah.
Next morning I wake up, my parents go to work, same feelings there again. So I'm home all day long by myself. And as I'm by myself, I'm trying to figure out, like, what's going wrong with me. And so my mom had old psychology books, and I'm a little bit of a reader. So I remember I'd just start reading through that, what's going on, trying to self-diagnose. Again, later that night, same thing, try to go to bed, turn the lights off, utterly terrified, have to go back out on the couch. And I don't remember if it was the next morning or a couple days later, but this kept happening. And one morning, my dad gets up early to go to work. My mom and dad both do. And I remember my dad saying, why does he sleep on the couch every night? Now, mind you, I'm home with my parents because I wanted people not to get the wrong impression of my parents. I wasn't out drinking the night before. I'm not using drugs. Like, there's no, like, clear sign that anything's wrong because I'm home with them each night.
Right, right.
And so my mom I remember saying something along the lines of, like, college kids are weird. Like, you know, he's falling asleep watching TV.
Yeah.
And they kind of dismissed it. But my dad did make that comment. I remember I was awake, so I heard that and kind of realized that I think something might be wrong. But I thought, you know what? I'll just go back to school, get back in my old routine. Everything will be fine. I go back to school, and this feeling keeps happening. Hmm. And it starts intensifying. For the next 2 months, every night I would go to bed, I was utterly convinced I was going to die in my sleep. Hmm. Now, as we'll see in a few minutes, that wasn't what was happening. But I thought I was going to die in my sleep. And so each night, the terror that I'm going to die at any moment was with me all the time. I would go to classes, and I'd be sitting in class. I remember one distinctly, I'm sitting in a class with a ton of students. Chairs are crammed together. And I remember being so terrified in that moment that I would just white knuckle grip the desk and just hoping no one would talk to me. Because it took all my willpower to not run out of the room screaming.
Wow.
It was really, really traumatic. I did this for 2 months and didn't tell anybody, not my parents, not my friends. I don't know what to tell them. And so finally I broke down and said, I need to go see a psychologist or something. So I go to the see a psychologist on campus, and I walk in the room and he said, well, why are you here? I said, well, I'm crazy. He goes, no, you're not. I go, what do you mean, no, I'm not? Like, you just met me. He goes, you're not crazy. He goes, crazy people don't know they're crazy. You think you're crazy, so you're not crazy. And I can't tell you, 20 years later, how much of a relief that was when he said that.
Right, right.
Because I thought, okay, I'm not nuts. Because, yeah, right, people who think they're a glass of orange juice don't know that. Like, I do know I'm nuts. So it was very reassuring to me. Mm-hmm. So we start talking. I describe my symptoms to him. And he says, well, what you're having are panic attacks, anxiety attacks. And so, which may not sound to a viewer that's never had one, maybe doesn't sound as bad. Like, we've all been a little anxious before. And so at first I was a little embarrassed, like, this is messing me that bad. And the psychologist said, no, panic attacks are utterly terrifying. And so he says, your reaction to what's going on is very normal and it's very understandable. And if a viewer wants to know what it's like to have an anxiety attack, think of the time in your life you're the most nervous, where you can't breathe, you feel dizzy, your heart won't stop beating, you feel sick. When we feel those in normal day-to-day life, it's because something in front of us is making us feel
right,
that way.
There's an object of the focus. Yeah.
Correct. For me, it would happen out of the blue.
Right.
I'd be sitting in class taking notes, and this would just come on me. And I'm looking around. I can't see anything that's causing me to feel this way. And then you become anxious about the anxiety, and it just compounds.
Yeah.
So I tell the doctor this. He says, do you use drugs and alcohol? And I said, yeah, I do. He says, well, how much do you drink? And I read somewhere once that when you ask somebody who has a problem with alcohol, how much they drink, it's always twice as much of what they say, which proved true for the me. I said, well, 10 to 12 a night. And it was probably, if I'd start drinking early enough, it could be twice as much as that. I said, 10 to 12 a night. He goes, well, you know, that's a lot of alcohol. I said, I know. He said, well, what's happening is your body, you're getting so high that when you crash, your body doesn't know what to do. It goes into shock. And so, and then when it goes into shock, it falls down underneath and it's got to bring you back up. And so he explains what's going on. He gives me some strategies to deal with it. He said, when these come on, there are ways you can settle yourself down. So he taught me how to breathe, diaphragm breathing. I could get a bag to breathe into. And actually that training's come in a lot of help over the last 20 years. but he explained me how to get it down.
Yeah.
I said, well, I'd like to see a medical doctor just to make sure I'm not dying for sure. And he goes, that's a great idea. Go downstairs. They'll give you a physical. Get the physical. I mean, I wasn't in great shape because I'm drinking so much, but they said, no, you're fine. At that moment, I'm walking out. He told me, make sure you schedule an appointment. We'll meet again next week, start talking about, you know, some of these issues. And I was walking down the hallway and I thought, if I keep coming, he's going to tell me I have to stop drinking. I know what these are now. I'm not dying. And I really like getting drunk. So I'm just going to live with them. And so for the next year, I would get drunk on a Tuesday night, on Wednesday feel mildly anxious. Then I would go on a binge Thursday, Friday, Saturday. By Sunday, I knew Sundays were going to be horrible. So on Sundays, I would just tough it out and try to relax myself, knowing that by Monday, I'd feel a lot better. I usually had meetings Sunday night, so I'd have to spend all day kind of getting myself prepared for that. And I just toughed it out for a year.
Wow.
So while this is happening, the girl I mentioned earlier, Corinne, is sharing the gospel with me quite a bit. And as she's sharing this gospel with me, I start realizing that, like, my sin's what's destroying me. It got to the point when I would brush my teeth, I couldn't look at myself in the mirror. I just couldn't even look up because I didn't like the guy looking back at me. And the hound of heaven, the Holy Spirit, was chasing me very heavily. And I think God was subtly reminding me that I'm handing you over to this thing, but I want you to come back. And in January 2004, it's my senior year of college, they gave me an extra year because I didn't do all my classwork for the partying. So I got that extra year, which would pay off a great deal.
Yeah.
But in January 2004, my senior year, it was a January day. It's snowy out and sunny. And if anyone's ever been in Ohio in the winter, a sunny day in January is rare. So it was a very beautiful day. There was white snow on the ground. And I was reading the parable of the soils, the parable of the sower, the four soils. And I'd read this passage a bunch of times. And I'm reading through it, and it talks about the fact that the God's word is like seed, and it falls on soil. And if it falls on rocky soil that's super, or pardon me, soil that's hard, it just doesn't take root at all. But it can also fall on soil that has thorns and thistles, or has rocks and thorns. And in that one, the seed will take a little root, but it gets choked out by the cares of life. Being worried about what people think about you, if you take the word seriously, the pleasures of life choke it out. And then there's good soil that the seed sticks and grows and produces fruit. Well, I always had a fatalistic reading of this. Like, I'm just a guy with, I'm too afraid of what people think about me if I took my faith seriously. I'm too attached to pleasure to give it up. I had a fatalistic reading. I'm always going to be the person with the rocks in the soil. So yeah, I read the Bible and it sticks a little bit and then dies. I go to church and then it dies. And in that moment, the Holy Spirit spoke to me. He said, maybe if you removed the rocks and the thorns, it would stick. And this meant silly to say this because it's sort of obvious, but that's the first time that occurred to me.
Yeah.
And I thought, if I start removing these things out of my life, maybe it'll stick. And I remember getting on my knees and I prayed to God and I said, I will give you 3 months. Because I knew I can't give him like one day. Like, I knew enough that that's not a fair shot for him. I said, I'm going to give you 3 months, but I need you to come through. Because if you don't, I'm just going to drink myself to death. Like, but I said, I'll do my part. And I, that night or maybe the next day, I was with Corinne. We had to do a project together and she's dropped me off at my house. And I said, hey, your friend Pete, who leads that Bible study you can try and get me to, go ahead and give him my number. I'll go. And I mean it this time, because I'd said that in the past. I said, I mean it this time, I'll go. And she calmly just nodded her head. Okay, great, great. I got the car. And she told me later, she just went crazy. Like, she was so excited that I was going to do this. And so I gave God his chance. Started going to a Bible study. Got involved with Campus Crusade for Christ. I quit drinking the best I could. I wasn't perfect. But I was drinking 4 nights a week for 3.5 years. Probably maybe, I don't know, 5 to 7 times over a 2-month period I got drunk, which... that's a lot for a person who's a serious Christian. That's a problem. But at that stage in my life, that was a big improvement.
Right.
Started exercising in the morning, studying more, and started really getting my life together. What happened after about 2 months is, of course, I get the attention of the people on staff at Campus Crusade, that this guy's turning things around. I started sharing a little bit of my background, a little bit with the guys. Mm-hmm. And finally, Pete introduced me to a guy on staff named Tobias. And Tobias met with me. And he said, what I think you need to do is go on a mission trip over spring break. I said, okay, where? And he said, to Panama City Beach, Florida, to share the gospel with partiers on the beach. And I said, I don't think that's a good idea for someone like me. And he said, no, I think it's perfect. And so I said, I swear to you, before God, I swear that I was going to say no. And I think this might be the only time that God controlled my mouth and uttered a different answer. But I just said yes. And so I raised support, and I'm going to go on this trip. Well, none of the guys in my Bible study are going on this trip. So everyone going on this mission trip, I don't know any of them. Because Crusade was a big movement at that point. OU, mm-hmm. There's 450 students.
Right.
Well, a few days beforehand, it's St. Patrick's Day. Now, my buddies, all my roommates were atheists and agnostics. I did not tell them the religious part of my life change. But I did tell them I was trying to exercise, cut down on the drinking. And that part they understood. I mean, we're all seniors at this point. Right. You know, a lot of us, we need to get beyond, you know, a lot of us quit smoking weed at that point. Like, we're trying to, like, transition into adulthood. So that didn't bother them too much. But they just said, man, you never hang out with us anymore. St. Patrick's Day, just come on out. I was like, well, I'm 21. I'll just go have one or two, and then I'll head home. And the next thing I know, I woke up on this girl's floor staring at the ceiling. No idea how I got there. Not really sure what happened the night before. And I leave. And I'm walking home, and I thought, I can't go on a mission trip. Like, I'm too much of a hypocrite. But then it occurs to me, I just raised $1,500 of support. If I don't go, I have to return the money. If I return the money, I have to explain why. And this might be the only time maybe in life where God used the sin of pride to move his plan along.
Right.
But pride just took over, and I'm like, I can't do that. I got to tough it out. Mm-hmm. So I went, and I'm sitting on the back of this bus, and we're driving to Florida, and I'm looking at this sea of happy Christians in front of me. And I couldn't stand any of them. The one thing that annoyed me when I was in college is how happy Christians were. It drove me nuts. Mm-hmm. That I mean, how sick is that? But like, that was a very revealing of me.
Yes,
but their happiness like drove me crazy. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting on this bus looking at them and I go, I don't even like these people. I don't want to be around them. I have to do this for a whole week. Well, of course, I get down to Panama City Beach and it changed me forever. one of the girls, they would team us up with a girl, and we would walk the beach and go up to random people and ask them if they want to talk about Jesus. And we had different inroads to make that happen, but that's what we were doing. And we were going out, and I'm so nervous. And the girl I was with goes, she was really bubbly and wonderful. And she goes, I'll do all the talking. You just stand there. I said, sweet. So, I'll go to the worship each morning, and I just stand around in the afternoon. And she initiated the first conversation. It went so-so. And finally, just, I'm not one of those types of people that do things, half-hearted. So when I played football, I was all about football. When I partied, I'm like, I'm going to be the best partier at OU. And so I'm like, well, if I'm down here to share the faith, I just got to jump in. So I said, I'll do the next one. And so I started talking to these two guys, and I thought, I'm just going to tell them the truth. And I told them what I just told you. I told them about St. Patrick's Day. I said, a week ago, I was drunk. And I said, but Jesus Christ loves us, and he's got a better plan for us than this. And if he can forgive me, he can forgive you guys. And I was just honest with these two guys. And they stopped, and over time, they looked at me, and they go, the party life is, it's not worth it. And then they start telling me, they're having the same experience in the party life I was before. And so where I thought I was all alone in all this suffering with the sin, what I discovered is there's lots of people who struggle with this. And that boost of confidence, for the next 5 days, I was just honest with everybody I talked to. I think it took down their barrier, because I would admit that I was fallen and sinful, and I certainly wasn't talking down anybody, but it was liberating me to tell them God has more for us, and he'll forgive us for everything right here and right now, and he can put you on a new path right now. And that's what he did, not only for in those some of those guys' lives through me, but by the end of that week, I remember sitting on the beach looking at the ocean, the waves coming in, and I thought, I'm never going back to that. And from that moment on, I mean, my hair was on fire for Christianity. I mean, I went back to my campus, and my parents, when I visited them, were just like, what in the world happened to you? I left their house in January, fat, drunk, and stupid. And then 2 months later, I'm going on a mission trip. I'd lost like 25 pounds. I'm on fire for Christ. I'm not interested in smoking weed and chasing women and drinking anymore. And really, that week just set me on an entirely new path.
Well, let's take a break there, but a thought before we go to the break. It's interesting that the part of the turning point was precisely you being in this position to tell your testimony. Mm-hmm. Because up to this point, it's interesting. Many stories, oftentimes people are, if they're getting into drugs and alcohol and things like that, it's because they've got some brokenness that they're fleeing from, and we all have that a little bit. But in your case, you really were kind of explicitly chasing happiness. Mm-hmm. But it seems like in those conversations where you actually had to put it out into words, that's where the unfulfillment of it.
Exactly right.
Really came home to you. Fascinating stuff, man.
Yeah.
Let's take a little break there. We'll
absolutely
come back and hear the rest.
All right.
Again, we're joined tonight by Michael Mason, former evangelical Protestant. We're going to hear the rest of his story here in just a couple minutes. I want to encourage you, if you have a conversion story, if you are a convert to the Catholic Church, we'd love to hear that. If you go to chnetwork.org/contact us, we'd love to hear your story. Or if you are someone who's thinking about becoming Catholic, we'd love to be praying for you and walking with you on your journey. We'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Michael's story. See you then. Welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of our hour tonight, speaking with Michael Mason. He's a former evangelical Protestant and is now a Catholic high school teacher in the Archdiocese of Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. Michael, thanks for sharing your story with us tonight. It's been really fascinating so far. We left off, you just had this great experience of sort of falling into this mission trip, and giving it a go and discovering in your own testimony, your need for Jesus and your need for faith, and you're beginning to see your life turn around. Pick us up there and tell us what happened next.
Yeah, so I had this life-transforming moment down there. And sharing my story and being honest with guys helped me to clearly see what was going on. What also helped, too, is I saw the party life with sober eyes for the first time. I could kind of step back and look at it and see its depravity. With when you're in it, you can't always see that. And so those two things together really made it real impactful. When I got back to OU, my hair was on fire for faith. I was ready to go. I was meeting with that same Tobias later and basically saying, I want in leadership. I mean, I took the energy I had for partying and just applied it to Christianity. And of course, they're trying to calm me down a little bit and slow things up. But I was ready to go. And when you have a testimony like mine, people who have to raise support and money for their ministry are gravitated towards people like me because it's very tangible that God's doing something big. And so I've been invited many times to give my testimony. And that was true then as well. We would have once a week on Thursday nights, we would have our weekly meeting. And it was big. There'd be a band playing, a speaker. And they invited me to give my testimony at that. And this was really the first time for me to say it in front of people. And I was in front of 450 people. I invited all my friends so that they were finally going to hear, because I wasn't ashamed now. So now I'm going to evangelize with them too. And so I invited all of them to this moment. Well, they said, we're not going to have you just show up and talk because you'll go on too long. And so the gist was they would team me up with someone and that person walks me through their testimony. And so there was a girl named Jenny and she was friends with Corinne. So I knew her a little bit and they said, you guys will meet. So Jenny calls me and she says, let's go to Dairy Queen or something. I'm going to walk you through your story and help you get it down to, a 7 to 10 minute story. And she can tell. And I said, that's fine. So we sit down and she says, I know you're about to tell me a lot of really personal things. She goes, so I just like to tell you my background as well so that, you feel more at ease sharing this really personal stuff. So she told me her background and how she met the Lord in a really impactful way. And it was a really beautiful story. So she tells that to me and says, okay, now tell me yours. And so I lay out my story to her with all the gritty details that I just shared with you. And then after we were done, we sat and just talked for about 2 hours. And a year and a half later, she was my wife, which is why I'm very happy that I had to stay an extra year at OU because mm-hmm. I could have left without her, right. Which would not be good. It was kind of a funny way to start a relationship when you tell each other basically the worst parts about yourself right out of the gate. Everything looked rosy from there afterwards. but she walked me through that. We didn't start dating for a while later. We were just friends for a long time after that, because at that point I thought, I liked her. But then I thought, I'm not really sure what to do with a Christian woman. Like, these girls are too good for me. And I interact with lots of not so virtuous women. I don't know what to do with a virtuous one. I think I need to grow up a little bit. And then I got the thought in my head at some point. It had to come from God because it's probably too wise to come from me. But I thought, I think I want to get married. And what should I look for? And I got the thought, I said, like Jesus Christ is the most important thing to me. So the first thing a girl has to have is she has to love Christ more than she'll ever love me. That's the first thing. Second thing is she has to just be fun. We're going to do life together. I want this thing to be a grand adventure. And I want a girl that wants to go along with that adventure. And then she has to be cute because I'm a guy. Right. And so I thought those are my parameters. And, that first one, Jenny fulfilled all three, by the way, and still does. Getting the thought in my head that I had to marry a woman that loved Christ more than she'd ever love me, that prepared us for a future that neither one of us could have ever imagined. When we were sitting in that Dairy Queen in Athens, Ohio, we would never imagine we'd become Catholic someday. And so the fact that she wanted a man who loved Christ more than loved her, and I wanted a woman that loved Christ more than she'd ever love me, really gave us our marriage the spirit necessary for God to do what he was going to do later. So right. God's wisdom was just at work in us, and we had just had no idea what was going on. Mm-hmm. Like, his providence was just complete control. So we meet. About this time, I'm sharing my faith like crazy. And my roommates are patient with it at first, and then they start pushing back because they're all atheists and agnostics. Mm-hmm. And so they're posing questions to me, and do you really think God exists? And you believe a carpenter from Nazareth rose from the dead? Like, what are you talking about? And I didn't have any answers for them. And so when they would go partying, I would get online and look up answers and start reading books and things. And so as I'm answering their questions, some of the answers I'm having a hard time finding the answers for. And then I'm going to atheist websites, reading their material. And I had a little crisis of faith right out in that summer, that first summer, because my life had cleaned up at this point. Morally, I was cleaned up. Physically, I was much better off. Socially, I had real positive friends. These new Christian friends were very positive. But the Christian life also, it's a struggle. It's not an easy thing to live out. Taking up your cross and following Christ is difficult. And so some of the difficulty started in at that point. So some of the consolations God gives us in the beginning,
right.
Maybe for some people, they have a very long honeymoon. Mine was a little bit shorter, mm-hmm. Where the struggle of it became very in the forefront. And I remember I didn't have any money. So I told my pastor, I said, I'll come do work out of the church. I don't need money to give you for tithe, but I'll work to donate some of my time. He said, that's great. And so I remember I was weeding and things, and he comes out and we're talking, and I said, I'm really struggling with some doubt. And I threw it out to him, and he was a good man, but he looks at me and goes, yeah, those will go away. And I thought, oh yeah, they will. And then he went back inside and went down to weed. And I thought, what if they don't? Like, that's not good. Mm-hmm. And so I had a real crisis of faith there. Luckily, on the radio, I heard what later I learned was what a Christian apologist is. And so I stumble along the radio station, and there's a guy in there defending the faith. And what I discovered is that there's a discipline in theology called apologetics where you can answer people's questions, and there's good answers. And so when I discovered this re-enlivened my faith. You know, I'm only a few months into it, but re-enlivened it. And so I just started reading like crazy to try to get at like how to answer people's questions. My zeal got out in front of my wisdom a lot. My zeal got way out in front of me. I would offer to give talks and things like this in places when I just didn't know what I was talking about. I thought I did because I read this one book on this one topic. And so quite a few times I'd put myself out there and get smacked back down pretty good, which was instructive that maybe it did make sense that St. Paul had to go away for a few years to prep before ministry.
Right.
Maybe I should too. But I really set on fire for this. And so we finish up that next year. We were invited to go on staff with Campus Crusade. I thought, I really like teaching. I'm not sure what God wants me to do. My wife is a teacher as well. We got married and we thought, well, let's just move to Charlotte, North Carolina. And the reason why for Charlotte is at that point, all the baby boomers are still teaching in Ohio. So there's no jobs. And Charlotte was hiring like crazy. So we moved to Charlotte and I'm reading these books and I'm teaching English. We lived in Mooresville, North Carolina, just north of Charlotte. And I'm teaching middle school English at Mooresville Middle School. And I'm just reading apologetics books at night just for fun. And in time, I came to an author by the name of Norman Geisler, very famous, probably for my money, probably one of the best Christian apologist there is in the evangelical world, especially. And I'm reading one of his books on Islam. And as I'm reading, I thought, man, I wonder where this guy works. And I flip the book around. It says the founder and president of Southern Evangelical Seminary in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I thought, holy cow. I walk out and tell my wife, this guy's school is in Charlotte. It's like an hour away from here. And so I said, I think I need to go out and check it out. Because I didn't realize you could do something like teach apologetics for a living. And so I go down there and discover they have master's degrees in apologetics and in biblical studies and in philosophy and in masters of divinity and all this great stuff. And so I go down to one of the admissions counselors, and it's a gentleman by the name of Doug Beaumont, which is actually, he's been on the show before.
Your name, yeah.
And so I met with Doug and you were talking through the program, and I just think this is what I want to do. And so I enroll in the program and I start attending Southern Evangelical Seminary. As I'm attending, I initially was going to do a master's of apologetics. And what I discovered in time is that to be a truly good apologist, you have to be a good philosopher. Because apologetics, and it's a wonderful discipline, and I love it, and I have lots to thank for it, it's a little bit ad hoc. And what I mean by that is when you study apologetics, you just answer people's questions. But the way you're answering them, you don't do the hard work of how are all these ideas tied together.
Right.
And so what I started realizing that is what I really need to study if I wanted to know my beyond my game is to study philosophy so I can answer the philosophical questions, but also a systematic theology. Because if I could be trained in that, like a real principled understanding of what I was saying, then I could answer questions. I didn't have to memorize answers to questions. I could actually get to the root of where they were coming from. And so I took a class by a gentleman that was a great mentor to me, and now he's one of my best friends, named Jason Reed. He's also been a guest on the show.
That's right.
and he was an excellent professor. Philosophy can draw guys who are a little on the nerdy side. And for a guy like me who likes sports and things, I needed someone like him because Jason's brilliant, super smart, articulate, charismatic, but he loves sports. So we would, you know, do all this great philosophy in class and then talk about college football and during breaks and things. So he was like the guy I needed to walk me through this. Well, I took my first class with him before I'd switched majors, and we did modern contemporary philosophy, and I was completely lost. Like, it was one of the worst experiences of my life. It was 1 week of intense philosophy. I'm studying all these things. And I get to the end of that, and I thought, this isn't for me. Like, I'm not smart enough to do this. It's too hard. If I can't do this, I shouldn't do apologetics. I'll just do an MA in Christian ministry or something. And so I finished the course. I get an A. He always reminds me that was he was being a little bit kind with that. But I did get an A on it. And I thought, wow, I got an A, but never doing that again. So that's that. Well, I was supposed to take an intro to apologetics class with Dr. Geisler, which I was real excited about. At the last minute, he had to pull out of the class, and in walks Professor Reed, Jason Reed. And I thought, not this guy again. Like, he just destroyed me. And the apologetics class was it was a more entry level. And so I take the entry level part, and we're going through the ideas he taught me in the summer again. And I thought, I think I learned more than I thought I did. And so we're in the hallway, and I'm talking to a guy in my class, and we're going over Hume's thoughts of relation of ideas and matters of fact and stuff like that. And this guy's like, I just don't understand. It makes no sense. So I said, well, I think I know what he means. I explain it to him. As I'm explaining it, Professor Reed walks through. He goes, what are you two talking about? And so I told him, I'm answering his questions on, he goes, what'd you tell him? And so I tell him what I told him. And he goes, yeah, that's right. And he walked. And at that moment, I'm like, I'm going down and switching my major. So I'm switching to philosophy. And so at that moment, I just switched to philosophy and just fell in love with that. I took as many classes as I could from him as possible. And I was there during the glory days of Southern Evangelical Seminary. The school was really healthy. It was going really well at that point. The professors were fantastic. And the group of guys I was in class with were really, really sharp guys. A lot of PhDs came out of that program. And not only were they really sharp, and Jason was an excellent professor, but also these guys, we legitimately loved Christ a great deal. And so what was great about us, we're studying all these ideas that are antithetical to Christianity. Like, if these ideas are true, Christianity is not. And that can be really intimidating to face those things. But when you're doing it alongside guys who are really bright, who are fun to be around, and who love Christ more than anything, it made the experience fantastic. And so all of us in this class are doing all this great material. And the way the classes were structured is we would study all these other people's ideas in metaphysics and epistemology or moral philosophy or whatnot. And then, you know, near the end of the class, we'd say, well, what does Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas say about this? So everything was always kind of through that lens of Thomas Aquinas. And so we would then look back and say, okay, this is what this thinker's getting correct. Okay, here's some insights he has that it's helpful. Here's some things he's wrong about, but that's also helpful because it teaches us what not to do. And here's how Aquinas threads that needle. And so that's how I was taught to study and read philosophy. And I just fell in love with Thomas Aquinas. Yeah. And I fell in love with that Dominican tradition. What I loved about Aquinas is, again, the difficulty of philosophy is intimidating. Even if you love it, it's intimidating. Most, if you talk to any philosopher, young philosopher, what they'll tell you is, I'm not smart enough to do this. Mm. And the answer is always, that's true, but just keep going.
Right.
Like, none of us are real great at this because it's such a difficult thing.
Yeah.
It takes a long time. It's a lifetime endeavor. But one thing I loved about Aquinas is he loved the truth. He'd follow it wherever it went, but he loved our Lord in a way that was undeniable.
Yeah.
Like, he loves Christ and he's humble. So he's, you know, maybe the smartest human being that ever lived. He's definitely top five, but he's got humility and he sits under Christ's instruction and under the church instruction. And I remember that humility was helpful for me when I was doing my studies, because I thought, you know, that's why I need to be humble when I approach these. And so following Aquinas's lead, he started becoming my patron saint before I understood that that was allowed. Mm-hmm. And so as I'm doing these studies, eventually what happened is I started turning my philosophical reasoning skills onto the theology I was being taught in my other courses. And I saw a drastic difference between what we were doing in philosophy class and then the rigor of the theology program I was getting. And as I started turning that lens, another crisis in my life started to hit. For people who have never converted, especially an intellectual conversion, it's very difficult to understand how that works and why it takes so long. But the best way I can describe it is, you have to go through a paradigm shift or a worldview shift. And so what happens is, a worldview is how you explain everything around you. So if I was to philosophically explain what you and I are doing here right now, I'm going to bring my Christian view into it because that's how I understand all of reality.
Right.
When I was a Protestant, I understood the world from a Christian perspective, an evangelical Christian perspective. And that paradigm explained a lot. And so I could rest in it, and it gave my life purpose and meaning and direction. As I started studying more theology, there started to be things that were anomalies at first, because every worldview has tensions. Right. Even the Catholic one does. We have difficulties and right. things
Mysteries
we believe.
And, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's always tension. But as long as the tensions are only about 1% of your belief, it doesn't matter. Because there's like, you know, my faith explains the 99%. What happens is slowly it starts to chip away at it. And what happens slowly is through studying theology and looking at sola scriptura and sola fide and the real presence, I started realizing that what I was so sure and comfortable in that was true was slowly being chipped away 1% at a time. And I got to a point where I started having a crisis of faith, because now my worldview, my way of understanding life and reality, the thing I've built my life on since college, isn't making sense of the data, of scripture, of church history, of all these things.
Right.
And that's where I started to discover, like, I need to start looking at the Catholic Church, because the Thomas Aquinas is shedding so much light. And he's studying all this theology, and I'm starting to wander into his theology, and that stuff started making a lot more sense. And so as I started turning my gaze onto that, I started critiquing all those beliefs I had before. And as that started to happen, I started to realize that the Catholic worldview was now, it could explain the part of evangelicalism that was correct. So it was all there. All the positives are there.
Right.
Devotion to scripture, mm-hmm. evangelization, relationship with Christ.
The basic gospel.
It's we're good there.
Yeah.
But then all these problems I'm having, it's answering all of those. So now my worldview is filling back in. Well, as my worldview is filling back in, that's called a conversion. A lot of times you don't realize it's happening. Because in a weird sense, conversions are very slow and then extremely fast in my experience.
Yeah.
The slowness is that paradigm shift. You have to do all this investigation and prayer and study and reading and thinking and talking. And then you come to a head and you got to switch. And that's what happened to me as I came to a head. And at this time, I was slowly talking to my wife about it. And I finally came to a point and I said, I need to become Catholic. I walked her through a lot of the theological reasons that I was seeing. And she was a little bit reluctant. She was raised in a Church of God, Assembly of God. Great parents, very faithful people. Her experience was more rich faith-wise than mine. But because she loved Christ more than she loved me, because she took the scripture seriously and she trusted me and she said, you know, you're the spiritual head of our family, And I trust you. You're a thoughtful guy and a prayerful guy. She was willing to walk with me through that. And she knew full well she was going to have to come to it on her own. So we entered RCIA at a church in Salisbury, North Carolina. And I did my research to find a good parish to come into. And I found one with, it was beautiful. It's funny because my wife, she liked evangelical culture more than I did. Like, mm-hmm. you know, the contemporary Christian music. And I wasn't into all that stuff. And I said, hey, like, we can go to this one parish. They have more like band stuff. This one's more like organ and incense. And she goes, Mike, if we're going to be Catholic, we just should go the whole, I just want to go the whole in. So she actually said, let's just do the incense and the organ. Went to this beautiful church, had a great new young priest teach RCIA. And through this year watching my wife, she slowly started coming to it on her own. And the thing that stood out to her was apostolic succession. It was like November that year. They lay out the fact that you can trace the popes through history. And my wife on the way home just said, we can do, that's true. And she's just so excited.
Yeah.
And I said, honey, we can buy a poster with all their pictures on it if you want one. And from that point, we really kind of took off from there. And what happened is we're coming in the church and I was having discussions with Jason Reed, because at this point he'd already converted. And I said, you know, there's one theologically I'm good. I believe it. I said, but the Eucharist, the real presence, I'm not positive that he's there. He goes, what do you mean? I go, all theological stuff's gone. But like, is he really, is that really him? And Jason said, you're not going to know it till you do it. And I thought, faith is, it's not incompatible with reason. Mm-hmm. Reason can defend it and illuminate it, but I have to step, I have to assent. And I realized that I'm not going to know it till it's in front of me. And so at the Easter Vigil, I was there. And I walk up to the front and they hold up the host and they say, the body of Christ. And I stare at it and I thought, that is him. My Lord, my maker is right in front of me. And I was so overwhelmed. I didn't even say amen. And so I take communion. In that moment, I knew it. And so from there, our lives just took off. I was, God by his grace brought us up to Cincinnati. And really got us back on our feet. And when we were transitioning, in our faith to the Catholic part of our lives. We had a one-year-old at this point. My oldest is 11 now, James. And he was the first person into the church because he was born the summer before.
Right, right.
So he was baptized in January. So he holds it over our heads. He's been the Catholic longest. But I have a one-year-old. I was teaching high school theology at this point. Mm-hmm. I just converted to Catholicism. I was honest with the gentleman who ran my school. He was very gracious. He said, you know, can we just keep this kind of quiet for the next month or, and just finish the school year out? And he was very gracious, but I couldn't work there anymore. So I don't have a job. I have this one-year-old, and I didn't know where to go. And so I just prayed, Lord, wherever you want me to be, just whoever gives me a job first, that's where I'll go. And one of the guys in Charlotte was trying to get me to Charlotte Catholic High School, but that didn't work out in time. And I got a call from a Dominican named Sister Mary Aquinas in St. Gertrude Church in Cincinnati. And she calls me up, and she looks at my resume, Master's of Philosophy, and she goes, do you want to teach middle school? Are you sure? And I go, yes, ma'am. And so we did the interview, and I was hired a week before I became Catholic. Wow. But St. Gertrude was a wonderful step for us. It's a really strong, great community up there. And we just needed time to become Catholic. And I was still very zealous for my Catholicism, like I was in my initial conversion. But I was a little bit older, a little bit wiser. And I knew that like just resting in this community for a little while was a good thing. And I taught religion to middle schoolers. That was a great start for me.
Yeah.
Because it's just, I get to share the faith, this passion I have, but at a level that's, you know, for a convert's good. And I just had a nice few years to just settle into our new faith. And then from there, decided that I want to evangelize the world and decided to get a second master's degree in theology from the Athenaeum of Ohio, which is the seminary in Cincinnati. Got a job teaching high school, co-ed high school at Roger Bacon High School in Cincinnati. So I taught co-ed for 4 years. But my real driving passion was to evangelize men. And I was always hoping God would open that door for me. And I graduated from the Athenaeum in 2020 with my second master's. I had 8 years teaching experience at that point and was hired to teach in Cincinnati at an all-boys school, Archbishop Moeller High School. And so my driving passion right now, aside from my wife and my children, so we have 5 now.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, 10 years Catholic and you have 5 children. But James is our oldest. Mm-hmm. William is number 2. Then we have Eva and Luke and Mary Claire. And I'm mentioning their names because they'll want to hear themselves on TV. They're my driving passion and my legacy, of course. Mm-hmm. But God has opened a door for me to evangelize young men and help them to know Christ and not fall in the pits of what I did when I was their age.
Right.
And so I talk to them a lot about is I understand the appeal of what you guys are being tempted towards. This is why it's a lie. And we spend a lot of time with that. And the honor and the privilege is to every day in and day out, just preach the gospel, not only in deed, but in word. It's just a tremendous privilege. It's amazing to me that God would open that door for me.
Well, that's wonderful, Michael. Thank you for sharing your story. We just have a couple minutes left. If you take a moment, again, it's great to hear that you have this ministry now to young men, you know, like your own story. If there are some of those in the audience, people, you know, maybe caught up in that lifestyle or maybe later on in your journey, people who, you know, have this sense that their worldview just doesn't quite fit the data of their experience and what they believe, give them a word of encouragement to keep going.
Yeah. It's tough. It's tough giving advice when you don't know exactly where the guy is, of course.
Yeah.
For young guys, the reason why I started my story with everybody wants to be happy, because everybody does.
Yeah.
When I read Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, everybody had this drive. I wasn't special in it. I maybe thought about it more consciously than other 17-year-olds, but we all have this drive, and it's innate. And through either we think about what we're going to do to make us happy or we try things out and fail, we're all chasing after the same thing. And I encourage guys, I say, listen, when it comes to Catholic morality or spirituality of the faith, the fact you want to be happy is a good thing, and it's something worth being pursued. I don't want to turn that off. In the evangelical Protestant world, a lot of morals is very a don't. Mm. It's a rule-based religion.
Right.
You know, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this for Jesus. In Catholicism, it's ordered towards our happiness and flourishing.
Yeah.
Jesus in John 10:10 says, I've come to bring you life and life to the fullest. The life he's talking about is the life, the spiritual life, the life of sanctifying grace. The life, the only true life worth having is the one that Christ offers us in his church. And so I tell guys is, sin always, always ends in failure and death, always. either in small ways with venial sin or big ways with mortal.
Right.
But it always ends in the grave. Christ has come to bring you life. And then each guy one at a time work through that. And so I would encourage any listener or anybody watching that if you truly want life, Christ is the only one that can give it to you, but you have to give him his fair shot like I did. And once I opened that door to him, he took control from there.
Oh, words of wisdom. Thank you so much,
Michael. Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
God bless you. Thank you for your story, and thank you for your ministry. We'll be praying for it as it continues, and for your family.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for being here for this episode of the Journey Home program. I pray that Michael's story was an inspiration to you. I encourage you to share this story. If you go to chnetwork.org/stories, we'll have Michael's story, but it's also many stories from every different background of people who have come to know Christ. And I love those parting words of wisdom there that God put into our hearts this desire for happiness. But it's a question of what is the way to happiness? What is the way, the truth, and the life? And we propose to you that it is Jesus. And so we want to share that with you. Check out those stories. We'll be back again next week with another conversion story. See you then.